Lecture 3, Reconciling Policy with Supply and Demand.
One of the most annoying things about the supply and demand framework is that it combines two different things, one that it says explicitly and one that it implies. The explicit part is that these forces are somehow inevitable, that they exist whether you like them or not, they exist whether you want them or not. They simply produce what people desire and what businesses want to make. However, the implicit implication that a lot of people worry about, and the annoying part, is that somehow these inevitable forces have to be desirable. And I want to say one more time, there's nothing in economics that says this has to be desirable all the time or it has to be what we want. All we've got here is demanders who always want the price to be lower, suppliers who always want the price to be higher, and the two of them colliding together in such a way that the quantity supplied and the quantity demanded are equal to each other. Economics is a structure for thinking about this interaction. It doesn't dictate our social goals. It doesn't dictate what we want to accomplish. However, because so many social goals do involve some element of price or some element of fairness, the temptation with social goals is always to try and dictate the price, to control the price or set some limits to the price, and use that as a mechanism for guaranteeing our social goals. What I want to do in this lecture is, first of all, try to describe what goes wrong when we try and use price as a way of setting social goals, and then to explain other ways in which economists would find it much more acceptable or be much more willing to try and change things according to whatever goals you might have. First of all, let's talk about, politically speaking, what happens when the demand side of the market wins. When the demand side of the market wins in the sense that it manages to go to politicians and demand that price be set in a way that the demand side likes. And a standard example of this would be rent control. Let's think about what happens in a rent control law for a moment. Rent control effectively comes out of an argument which says the market price is too high. That value judgment comes in. The market price is too high. People can't afford apartments. Affordable housing is an important public goal. So we're going to set a lid on what the price can be in one way or another. We're going to make sure people are able to pay a lower price. Now, in a supply and demand framework, the consequences of this are relatively predictable. Imagine that what we're saying is, without this law, without this rent control law, the price would be higher than it is. So, we must be setting the law, setting the price below the equilibrium level. Well, what happens when we push down the price below the equilibrium level? Well, we've been through this before. A lower price is going to encourage people to demand more of the product. After all, the lower price makes it look attractive to them, so people are going to be more eager to get larger places and to stay in places longer. On the other hand, the lower price makes supplying the product less attractive. And as supplying the product becomes less attractive, people like landlords or people who might think about building properties or fixing up apartments are going to feel less excited about doing this. Now, in a normal market setting, if the price were below equilibrium, we would see all these demanders, we wouldn't see very many suppliers, and we would expect the price to rise toward equilibrium. There'd be pressure in that system for the price to go up. However, when the demand side has won, what exists is what we would call a price ceiling. And the price ceiling just means that there's a lid on the price. And although the price wants to rise, it wants to rise toward equilibrium, because after all, people are waiting in line, people would be willing to pay more, it can't rise, because there's a law which says that it can't rise. Now, what happens in a world with price ceilings? What happens in a world, to choose this example, with rent control? A standard example would be, for those of you familiar with it, the housing market of New York City, which has been our most rent-controlled city since after World War II. Well, when you try and control a powerful force like a market, a powerful force of nature, you have to expect that people interacting in that market will try to find ways around the laws and the rules that you set. After all, if you have a powerful river and you just say, well, it won't flow there, the force of the river is going to go off in different directions. And those different directions are very visible if one thinks about rent control. For example, one typical thing that happened in New York City was that there would be non-refundable key deposits, a deposit to get a key to the apartment. Non-refundable. Now, this, of course, was not higher rent. It was just a key deposit. Looked like higher rent to everybody, but it wasn't against the law. Another possibility is that instead of renting your apartment, you might turn it into a cooperative or a condominium, where instead of renting apartments in a building, people now own condominiums in a building. That avoids the rent control law, and it doesn't change your situation in terms of, it doesn't force the landlord to own something at a loss. Another possibility for the landlord is, since they're not allowed to collect very much in rent, they can let the property run down. And in some cities, I'm particularly familiar with some college towns like Berkeley or like Cambridge, Massachusetts, which had rent control for long periods of time, you could almost watch the housing stock just get older and older and grubbier and grubbier. Now trust me, this wasn't just because a lot of college students were living there, although I'm sure college students are pretty hard on the housing stock. If you go to other college towns that don't have rent control, like say Palo Alto in Northern California, you have beautiful, beautiful houses. A lot of it is because if you've got rent control, the landlord tries to economize on costs, and tries to economize on costs by not looking after things. So the result is things look older and grubbier and more run down. Another thing that happens often with rent control is if you've got a rent-controlled apartment and you're happy with that rent-controlled apartment, you never want to leave. In fact, even if you're moving away, you don't see why you shouldn't get some benefit from the fact that you have this rent-controlled apartment. So what you do is you sublet the apartment to someone else, and maybe they have to pay a higher rent. But you still have your nice rent-controlled apartment. So the fact that you rented the apartment in the first place means that you get to make money off the apartment now. Clearly, that doesn't really meet the goal of what rent control is all about, but unless you've got laws and policing for sublets, it's what's going to happen. And finally, a lot of rent control just means people stay there for long, long, long periods of time. Of course, the people who stay there long, long periods of time, some of them might be poor people, but a lot of them are probably just middle-class people who have a great deal on housing and see no particular reason to move. Now, there have been a lot of examples of rent control over time. I mentioned New York City before. A lot of Europe had strong rent control rules after World War II. A lot of third world cities have strict rent control in their capital cities. There are cities like Berkeley and Santa Monica. In fact, up to a few years ago, when a sort of a trend against rent control kicked in, there were 200 cities in the United States that had some form of rent control or rent regulation. So when I say these things are what happen, I'm not just sort of saying that based on the model. The supply and demand model, though, with a price ceiling in it, it helps explain why all of those things happen. And it cuts across all different countries, all different times, and all different political situations. However, it does seem, in a funny sort of way, that economists are now winning the argument about rent control. Cambridge, Massachusetts, for example, has decontrolled its rents recently and removed most of its rent control laws. And the result is, as you would expect, some people indeed did need to move out of their apartments, but there's also been an enormous building boom in Cambridge, an enormous number of new apartments going up. And in the long run, if you want your city to have a good housing stock, you've got to make sure that people are able to make a living by providing that kind of, by providing rents and by providing rental apartments. Let's think about the supply side of the market. Remember that in rent control, you have a situation where you can imagine that in a local town like Berkeley or like Cambridge, they have an election. And there aren't very many landlords in town, but there are a whole lot of students. And so all the students go, the demand side of the market votes that they don't want to pay more, and they set a price ceiling in place. What's the flip side? An example where instead of the demand side of the market winning, we have the supply side of the market winning. Well, a standard example for many, many years has been farm price supports. Farmers supply food, and farmers have, I think, an enormously difficult life. They work incredibly hard. They don't make necessarily a heck of a lot of money. And their livelihood, what they produce, is subject to enormous fluctuations in weather going bad, supplies going bad, or just in all the other farmers having a particularly good growing year or a particularly bad growing year. So farmers, certainly, I no way wish to say that farmers have life easy or that farmers are rich or farmers are doing really well. Farmers have a difficult time making money. In fact, a lot of small business people have a really difficult time making money. However, our nation has roots in farming, and going back, we have strong feelings about farmers and about the family farm, and farmers have a better time or an easier time going to Congress and making arguments that they deserve special support than do a lot of other industries. And for most of the 20th century, we've responded to that claim by farmers that they needed some support by passing laws which would help keep the price of farm products higher than it would otherwise have been. Now, our supply and demand framework gives us a completely clear way of understanding what will happen in that setting. Farmers essentially are saying the price is too low and it's unfair, that value judgment again, too low, unfair, that the price should be so low. So, what should we do? We should pass laws, and they work in a variety of different ways. But the effect of the laws is to make the price higher. So a farmer can make a decent standard of living, a fair standard of living, all those value judgments one more time. Now, from our basic notion of economics, we've been through this before. If you set a price above the equilibrium level, above what it would otherwise be, what do you expect to happen? Well, if the price is above the equilibrium level, we expect the higher price will be encouraging to suppliers. The farmers will supply more stuff. They will be eager and happy to supply more than they otherwise would. We also expect that on the demand side of the market, people will trim back from those products. And instead of buying those products, they'll shift and buy some other products instead. What will happen if we move above equilibrium is that we'll start to build up surpluses that will be encouraging the suppliers but discouraging the demanders, and as a result, more and more is going to get produced. Stockpiles will tend to build up. Now, this is kind of rule in a normal situation. If we just had a market operating and the price was so high, as those stockpiles built up, people would have to cut prices, and the price would head back down toward the equilibrium level. But when the supply side has won the political battle, there's now a law referred to as a price floor. It's called a price floor because it stops the price from dropping down toward the equilibrium level. And so the price would want to fall in a market, but it can't fall. It's not allowed to fall under the law. So what happens if you've got a price floor in place? Well, in a price floor, stockpiles build up, surpluses build up. And you have to think of some way of dealing with that problem of surpluses building up. We've come up with a variety of ways over time. One was that we tried to sell it abroad. We'd sell it to other countries. Sometimes we would give it away to other countries just to sort of get it out there somewhere. We would also pay farmers to produce, and then we would pay them not to produce. Particularly clever way of spending government money, that we would say, we need to guarantee you a high price so that you can have a fair, decent standard of living, but to avoid producing too much, we'll also pay you to retire some of your land and get it out of production so that we won't have too much out there and we won't build up large stockpiles. Now, you might say, why not just remove both sides of that? That's what a lot of economists would ask. Now, again, this notion that farm price subsidies will lead to stockpiles and surpluses is not something which is just unique to the United States in the 20th century. If you go over to Japan and you look at what happens in Japan with subsidizing rice, it's exactly the same problem. If you go to Europe and you look at what happens in Europe with subsidizing various farm products, exactly the same problem. If you go to third world countries, some of which offer particular guarantees to farmers, exactly the same problem. The supply and demand framework gives you an answer here. What happens when there's a price floor? And that answer works across many different countries, across many different situations, across many different settings. Now, does it really work in the way that we want it to work, though? Does it really end up helping farmers? I mean, after all, part of the argument I was making before is that when you try and block some powerful force of nature and you say the price will not go down, something happens. You can't just stop that river in its tracks. The force will flow into other places. What are some of the places that it flows with farmers? Well, the most common place it flows, I would say, is that if farm prices are worth more, then the land on which you grow the food is also worth more. Because after all, now the land can produce something of higher value. So what tends to happen when you have farm price supports is that the price of farmland goes up. And the people who really win are the people who own farmland and are selling it to others. On the other hand, if you're an average farmer who's leasing farmland, as many people do, sure, you find that the price of your product went up, but the land that you're leasing also went up in price. So you don't actually end up any better off than you were. And instead of helping farmers try and make a living selling their crops, what such laws tend to do is inflate the price of farmland. Now that may be a good or a bad goal, but it's a different goal than the one of helping farmers. Just as economists to some extent seem to have won the argument about rent control, they have also to some extent won the argument about farm price controls. In 1996, a major farm bill was passed in the U.S. which didn't go all the way, but went a long distance towards separating apart what farmers produce and the support they get from the government. Remember, from an economist's point of view, you shouldn't be using the price to help farmers. If you want to help farmers, there are a variety of ways of doing that, of providing them subsidies, and you can just provide them those subsidies. You don't need to try and set the price as a way of accomplishing it. The real problem with price regulation that we're sort of getting at here is that price regulation is a subsidy, but it's a subsidy which seems oddly untargeted. We sort of say, well, the price should be this way because it's fair. The price of apartments should be low. The price of farm products should be high. But we're not being very honest when we say that about, well, who's actually paying this? If we raise the price of milk for farmers, and then poor families are unable to afford milk, is that really our intention? That we were going to tax poor families, make them pay more for milk, so farmers would be better off? Or so that farmers who own the land where dairy cows live would be better off? Price regulation is a subsidy. It certainly helps someone. But it's a weirdly untargeted subsidy. And it flows in different pathways than one would normally expect. So when we think about subsidies, we would much rather have them be transparent. We would much rather think about what the trade-offs actually are than say, well, we're just going to set the price and then pretend that these trade-offs are not filtering around in the economy in one way and another. There are even countries out there, not so many as there used to be, but there are countries that used to have both the supply side and the demand side win in their political system. That is to say, they would guarantee low prices to those who are demanding product, and guarantee high prices to those who are producing a product. That was typically how Soviet Russia, for example, tried to manage its production. Now, when you think about that for a moment, that gets a little tricky. If you're going to guarantee that everyone who demands it can get it at a low price, and you're going to guarantee that everyone who produces it gets a high price, there's a gap there. How do you fill that gap? Well, the answer, of course, is that one way you can fill it is by having the government collect a huge amount in taxes from people so that people have very, very low wages, companies have very, very low profits, but your products are cheap. Effectively, they're taxing you and using that money to provide high prices. Another possibility, of course, is just that you get black markets and that instead of rationing or instead of determining who gets the good according to who can pay, it becomes who's got political pull. It becomes who knows who. Who knows someone who can do this? Who can meet someone who can get something off the back of a truck? Or it becomes who's willing to stand in line the longest? Who's willing to stand in line for several hours in order to buy something? And that becomes the way of determining the price that you pay. It's cheap once you get to the front of the line, but you had to stand there for half a day first. In the end, you can't subsidize everyone. You can't make everyone happy. You can't go to all the people who produce stuff and say, we're going to give you all a really high price, and you go to all the people who demand stuff and say, we're going to give you a really low price, and expect things to work out. We need to be hard-headed about this. Nikita Khrushchev was once quoted in the early 60s as saying, economics is not a subject that greatly respects one's wishes. And when you think about that business of trying to subsidize everybody in the economy, you recognize that you just can't do that. Someone has to pay at the end of the day. The overall lesson here is that the market is just too powerful to ignore. Remember, when we think about the force of demand, what we're really talking about is people's willingness to buy a product. And for most products, they do have some substitutes, they do have some options, they do have other places to turn. You can't force them to pay a certain amount, you know, without force of arms. that force of people wanting to do the best they can with their money is an extraordinarily powerful force. And you can't just dam it up or block it and say, well, you know, people just won't pay more for rental apartments. They just won't. Everyone will just accept the price controls the way they are. If people are willing to pay more, they're going to go out there and they're going to try and find ways around the price ceiling. And they will try and pay more. And of course, on the other side of the market, remember that supply is based on a desire to make money. If you can't make a buck doing something, then firms are going to produce less, or they'll produce it at lower quality, or they'll shut down altogether. You cannot force anyone, in a free society at least, to make losses year after year after year. I mean, the money has to come from someplace. You can't just force them to say, you have to lose money, or you're not allowed to make money. They will, of course, find ways to try and charge more. They will find key deposits. They will find alternative ways of doing things. And these forces, remember, are not coming just from one person or another person, one supplier or one demander. They're coming from all the people out there who are demanding things. They're coming from all the people out there who are supplying things. And when you try and come between millions and millions of demanders and millions of suppliers and say, you will not meet in a way which will make various people happy, where both people will feel better off, you have set yourself a heavy, heavy, heavy task. And simple price regulation really is nothing more than saying, we're going to just pass a law, we're not going to let you get together with these other people, even though there are people on both sides of the market who want to. That's just a very difficult thing to do. It's implausible on its face that it's going to work very well. At about that point, people get very grumpy with economists. And this is about the point where people tend to accuse economists of having a concealed agenda. They say, well, you may say over and over, you're not dictating policy. You may say over and over, you know, that people can have whatever social goals they want. You may say that you're not, you know, dictating, there aren't any right answers. But it sure sounds like you're saying there's some right answers, or at least some wrong answers. You're saying, basically, don't do rent control. It won't work. Don't help farmers. It won't work. Now, you can couch that however you want. But let's get the force of the critique clear. The force of the critique is that you're coming up with a justification which says we can't help these groups. And that justification, however you dress it up, pretty it up, whatever you say about it, it's not, you know, it's a statement. It's a political statement, and you should acknowledge it as being a political statement. Now, I think that argument is actually wrong. But it's an argument that has some merit. If you listen to a lot of economists talk, you can see why people would have that argument. And what I want to do to sort of take the edge off that argument is to say that economists are not against whatever goals you have. Economists are perfectly open to a wide, wide range of social goals. What economists are potentially against is particular methods of reaching those goals. And economists are going to say that some methods of reaching social goals are better in the sense that they work better. The trade-offs are better trade-offs than are other methods of reaching those social goals. There's a book I recently came out, which is called something like, Having Good Intentions and a Lot of Money is Not Enough. And I think that's actually a deep thought about economics. That the argument here is not about goals. The argument is, if you're going to achieve certain kinds of goals, then how are you going to do it? And are you going to do it in a way which has pretty good costs and benefits? Or are you going to do it in a way which pretends that it's all benefit and no cost, and where the benefits and costs flow in all sorts of weird directions that you might not have expected? Economists are very much in favor of the sort of the clear-cut trade-off kind of option. Let's bounce back to these two ideas we talked about a moment ago. Let's think about affordable housing for a moment. Let's say that our goal, for the sake of argument, is to provide more affordable housing. And that we'll accept that as being the goal that we want to have. Now, of course, this may not be your personal goal. My point here is not to say that it's a good goal or a bad goal, although actually I think decent housing is a good goal. My point is simply to say that if that is your goal, there are a number of ways of achieving that goal without resorting to price controls. And these ways make a lot more sense to economists because they avoid the problems of price controls. It's easy to think about these ways in terms of a supply and demand framework. If you think about supply and demand providing some equilibrium amount of housing in the market, and you say, well, what we want is either to have lower prices of housing or to have more housing provided, one or the other, those are our various goals, then the question becomes, well, can we shift supply and demand in such a way as to meet those goals? Can we make supply or demand move in a way that will meet those goals? And the answer is, of course we can't. We know how to move supply and demand. We talked about how to make supply and demand shift. For example, one possibility is, let's think about shifting demand for housing out. And the way of doing that is, we'll give money to the poor, or we'll give housing vouchers to the poor. We'll raise their income. And when the poor have more income, then they will be able to demand more housing at every given price. So one perfectly straightforward way to get more affordable housing is either give the poor money or give the poor some sort of a voucher that they can use to buy housing. That will work perfectly well, will make the demand shift out, and we won't have this problem of trying to set a price floor or price ceiling which just isn't going to hold up all that well. A second possibility. Instead of working on the demand side of the market, we could work on the supply side of the market. We could, for example, subsidize the building of low-cost housing, like housing which is going to have relatively small apartments. Or we could pass zoning laws that require that even if you build a lot of big apartments or big houses, in that same neighborhood or that same development, you have to build some small housing and some small apartments. Now, those, if you build some small housing and small apartments, then presumably they will sell at a relatively low price. And so you will have created affordable housing in that way. We can shift the supply out in that way. We can shift the demand out. Now, there are a variety of other ways we could talk about in terms of subsidizing suppliers or of subsidizing producers. But my point here is not so much to say that one of those is best. My point is to say that any of those is going to be better than rent control. Any of them. Because any of them are going to have fewer unintended consequences, and they're going to have more honesty. Any of them are going to be a situation where we say, here is where the subsidy is, here's where the money comes from, and here's where it goes, and here's where why we think it's worthwhile. Whereas with a price control, a price ceiling, we're not quite sure where the money comes from. We're sort of pretending it doesn't come from any place. We're not quite sure where the subsidy goes. We're not quite sure it helps the poor. We're not quite sure who it helps. All we know is that it's dramatically complicated, the situation in the market, and driven a lot of transactions underground where we can't see them anymore. So it's not that economists are against affordable housing. It's that if you're going to try and accomplish that goal, there are better ways to do it than by trying to pass a law about the price. Let me give you another example. Let's talk about farmers. And let's say that for the sake of argument, we believe that we should try and support farmers in one way or another. Now, variety of reasons for doing this. You know, I don't really want to take a stand here on whether, you know, this is really a great social goal or not such a great social goal. I mean, personally, I think there are a lot of poor small businessmen in society, and I think a lot of them probably need some support of one kind or another. And I'm not sure that it makes sense to kind of sort out farmers as being a group that deserves special assistance over some other groups that are out there. But providing certain kinds of assistance to all of them, the tax code or other things, again, it's a complicated subject. Let's say for the moment, though, that we just set all that aside and we just say, okay, we accept that our social goal is to help farmers because they are particularly vulnerable, perhaps, because of weather and things like that, because we have social desires to help keep American farming alive. And we're worried that otherwise it may disappear, particularly smaller family farms. So, what should we do to help them? Well, I've already said a number of times that setting price levels, guaranteeing them a high price, is perhaps not the best way of doing that. What would be some alternatives to make farmers better off? Well, we could give them money. We could say anyone who gets, say, more than half their income from farming gets 25% off on their income tax. That would be straightforward. It would have no effect on the price of farm goods, probably, or very little effect. And it would make a big difference in people's lives. We could also, that would be subsidizing the supply side of the market. We could also subsidize food buyers, work on the demand side of the market. We could, for example, give more out in food stamps to poor people. We could pay more for school lunches or, in a lot of areas of this country, school breakfasts. We could pay for research and development in universities and in extension programs so that farmers could provide food at more cost-effective ways and thus make more money because they would be able to do it more efficiently and compete better against the world. We could do any of those things. We could do all of those things. My point, again, is not to say that one of them is a better or a worse idea or a stronger or worse way of doing things. My point is just to say that I would choose any of those ahead of setting the price in the farm markets. Because setting the price is going to have all these incentive problems, it's going to build up stockpiles, it's going to lead to a variety of other problems that we just don't want to have to deal with. And any of these other methods will work. So, again, the fundamental underlying thought here is that farmers are going to, that whether it's housing to help the poor, whether it's price supports to help farmers, whether it's price ceilings or whether it's price floors, our point is that we don't want to be setting prices. That whoever you want to help, whatever your social goal is, there's always a better way to do it. A way which avoids these incentive problems and avoids the confusion. And in fact, that it's much more honest and upfront about what sorts of trade-offs we're facing. So when we think about these things, there's going to not always be a right answer, but I think there will be a wrong answer. I sometimes think that in the world we live in, that one of the ways of thinking about most of the public policy choices that face us is that with most public policies, there's a goal, and there might be 50 ways of meeting that policy choice. When you think about those 50 ways, probably the top 20 ways would all work okay, and the bottom 20 ways would all be lousy. And I sometimes think the goal of economics is not so much to help us sort out between the top two or three options what the best way is of doing things. Heck, any of the top two or three are work. The really good thing that economists want to try and do is avoid the bottom 20 options. If we can just avoid terrible mistakes, avoid things which lead to confusion and problems, and focus in on any of the things which will work somewhat better, then the world would be a better place. It's a modest goal, but I think it's worth trying to achieve. Economists in all of these things do have, in some sense, a hidden agenda. It's a hidden agenda about facing trade-offs openly. And in thinking about that agenda and what it means for public policy, we go back into sort of thinking about politics and economics and how the two trade off against each other. Let me try and make a few points about how economists think about these things and how it works for economists. One is that economists accept budgetary costs. Politicians don't tend to like budgetary costs very much. For a politician, I think one of the reasons that we are so often turning toward price ceilings or price floors or price control is that when you control prices, you can say it had zero cost in the budget. I mean, after all you did was set the price. You didn't actually spend any money. You didn't have to raise taxes on anybody. You didn't have to increase the government budget. You just passed a law, and with that law, you tried to accomplish your policy goals. Economists don't see any particular reason to try and evade the notion that things have cost or to pretend that things don't have cost by turning away from them and by just setting prices instead. Economists are much more likely to say, hey, yes, there's a cost. Yes, there's a benefit. Is the benefit worth the cost? Well, if so, let's pay it. If somebody's being subsidized, if we're subsidizing farmers, if we're subsidizing poor people, well, let's admit we're subsidizing farmers, or we're subsidizing poor people, or we're subsidizing whatever group we're picking. And let's give a reason for why we think that group ought to be subsidized. If we can't come up with a reason, well, then maybe we shouldn't be doing it. I think an awful lot of democratic decision-making, an awful lot of policy decisions would be greatly simplified if we had spelled out, okay, this is what we're spending and this is what we're getting. A lot of things would become either a lot more defensible or a lot less defensible if we were willing to lay out the costs and benefits in a clear way. So again, my point here is not against subsidies. It's not against interfering with the market. It's not against helping people who need help. All of those things are perfectly acceptable. My point is, when we do those things, let's do them in a clear way, and let's do them in a way which doesn't lead to incentive problems we don't want. A second thing that economists often want. They want the assistance that they give, if there's going to be a subsidy, they want it to be targeted. They want it to be particular to the group which is being helped. And that means being clear about the goal of what you're doing and the tool that you're using. For example, suppose the goal is to help the poor by providing them with cheap apartments. Well, if that's the goal, then we need to think about who is that group and how much, who are we affecting when we pass a rent control law. The poor might be 10 or 20% of the population. If our goal is to help that 10 or 20%, then why conceivably do we have an argument for having rent control that affects 100% of the population? After all, shouldn't we target in to that particular group, that 10 or 20% that we care about? Similarly, if we think about farms and we think about trying to help farmers, there's typically a feeling when you think about helping farmers that of what sort of farmer we're trying to help. We're not usually thinking about some giant agribusiness corporation that makes millions of dollars and has tens of thousands of employees. We're thinking about a relatively small family farm. So if we're trying to help relatively small family farms, then let's focus in on helping them. Let's limit our assistance to folks who own the land that they work on, or perhaps those who have a relatively small revenue in a given year. Why subsidize the entire market if what you're trying to do is work on just 10 to 20% of it? The same thing is going to be true, not just on the benefit side, but if we think about imposing costs, that we should like to have the costs be targeted appropriately as well. In general, I think that if something is an important social goal, then we should pay for it in a broad social way, presumably by collecting tax dollars and then deciding to spend those tax dollars. But think about where the subsidies are coming from in these examples. If we were to say, for example, that we're going to subsidize poor people for affordable housing, why should we have landlords be the ones who are responsible particularly for helping the poor? I mean, if this is a broad social problem, a broad social issue, then let's collect social money and let's spend it broadly. But why put the burden on that particular group? Similarly, if you think about helping farmers, and we think about who bears the cost of higher farm prices. If helping farmers is an important social goal, well, that's reasonable enough. But why would we put the cost of that completely upon consumers of farm products? Why would we say to consumers of farm products, you're the ones who have to support farmers? If it's a social goal to help farmers, why don't we collect money through a broad tax like our income tax and spend that money accordingly? Too often, we just get baffled, I think, in terms of price controls because we don't really know who we're subsidizing or who's paying the subsidy or who's receiving it. And as a result, the effects end up going at cross purposes to our intentions. A final point. We don't really want to hide the costs of what's going on here, and perhaps this is a similar point, but to the first two. But we really don't want the costs to be hidden away somewhere. I hope that what I'm trying to convince you of in these last few minutes of this lecture is that economists are not hostile to the poor. We're not hostile to farmers. We're not hostile to trying to help people. We're not hostile to changing the market. We just want to be honest about it. We want to be honest about who's paying. We want to be honest about who's being affected. We want to be honest about who's being helped. If you are a poor person and you move to a city and you find that it is impossible for you to get an apartment because all the apartments are filled up with people who are stuck in their rent-controlled places and are never going to move, that people are asking you for extra key deposits, that the apartments are run down and dirty and filthy, you find that you can't afford to buy basic goods like milk because farm price supports are keeping the prices higher, you can't get loans or something like that because all the money is flowing into these businesses that are subsidized in one way or another, well, you know, to say that those programs have their purposes or their goals, it ignores your situation. There are people throughout an economy who are affected by every government policy that we pass. I would say that dismal sciences are not those which focus in on saying sensibly who should benefit and who should pay, but the dismal sciences are those who would really like to ignore reality, who would say, hey, if it ends up that there are rich people living in an apartment on Central Park West and that poor people can't afford an apartment in the city, hey, rent control is just fairness. It's just decency. And if that's a consequence, well, I don't care about that so much. Or people who would say, well, if a poor family has a hard time paying milk and big agribusiness companies are making millions of dollars, what I care about is a fair price for farmers. If you phrase the issues in those ways, they sure sound a lot less clear-cut when you start talking about fairness and decency and value related to price. Ultimately, when you think about values and prices and you think about trade-offs between the two, it's typically most sensible of all just to let the price be a messenger. Let the price tell you about conditions of supply and demand in the market. Let the price be what the price wants to be. And then, if we want to make adjustments by giving subsidies, we want to have someone else pay for that, let's be clear about who's paying and who's receiving, and just let the price continue to be the messenger or the subsidy between the two. It's almost proverbial wisdom that it's a bad idea to kill the messenger. Messengers bring news. They tell you things are good or bad. They tell you about quantities. They tell you about supply and demand. But the messengers themselves are not evil. Those who go out and try and kill prices or try and just set them in one way or another are really trying to kill the messenger. And in killing the messenger, they distort what it is they're trying to accomplish. They lose the connection between their policy goal and the tool they're employing. They lose the connection, one might even say, between their policy goal and plain old common sense.